The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the 8th reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In chapters 26 to 32, Mario and Jane, as a family, were showing all the skeptics surrounding them that they could manage just fine as blind parents in a sighted-centric world. Jane was a meticulous housekeeper, and Mario's career flourished. He became a respected city judge and a prominent civic leader, winning many accolades and awards. Jane also assumed several leadership positions in the community, though she found being in the public eye rather stressful. Their third child was born, and they moved into a new house. And now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. Chapter 33, A Very Good Year. Jane is pregnant again? What does she want another one for? Ruth held the telephone receiver tightly to her ear, anxious to hear more news about her sister's pregnancy. I have no idea, replied Irma, the oldest of the three sisters. I don't know how she manages the three children she has now. I only have two kids, and they're a handful. When is she due? She told me sometime in the middle of August. Ugh, you know that my Paula Kay's birthday is in August. I know how hot and miserable it is to be fat in the summer. Does Pop know about Jane? Asked Ruth. Yes, he's worried about them managing such a big family and how Mario can afford to feed a family of six. But Mario's a lawyer, and I'll bet he makes enough money. I told Pop they'll be fine. Jane is a good mother, and she'll be able to handle four kids. But I don't envy her having a baby at age 40. That wears me out just thinking of it, said Irma. Me too. Thanks for calling. I need to start dinner now. Bye, Ruth said as she hung up the phone. Irma and Ruth weren't alone in wondering how Jane could manage four children. Reaction was muted on Mario's side as well, although Aletta and Antonio looked forward to the new addition. Neighbors and friends gossiped among themselves about the pregnancy, speculating on how a blind woman could raise one child, much less four. Four children would be costly, and Mario worried about making ends meet. It would be humiliating to fail as a lawyer and be forced to borrow money from his parents or his brother. While his law practice was growing, Mario's income was unpredictable. Some years were better than others. Having no car or other large expenses, the family lived simply and within their means. They had one television and one telephone. They rarely ate at restaurants and didn't travel on vacations. Mario hoped that his fourth child would be healthy and the necessary additional expenses low. Jane's main luxury was a cleaning woman who came once a week to help with the heavy cleaning. She mopped the floors, vacuumed, and cleaned the bathrooms. It would have taken Jane a long time to mop the kitchen floor, and even then, she couldn't see if she'd missed any spots. The children weren't supposed to leave toys on the floor, but if a crayon had fallen off a table, Jane didn't want to ruin the vacuum by running over it. Mario's guide dog shed constantly. Despite Jane's best efforts, it was impossible for her to sweep up all of it. She couldn't see or hear the fur fly away from her and the broom and the dustpan. The cleaning woman saved Jane much time and worry, giving her the satisfaction that at least once a week the house was thoroughly clean. With no income of her own, Jane was completely financially dependent upon Mario. She couldn't see to write a check, so Jane had no checking account. Credit cards were 10 years in the future. Mario gave her a weekly cash allowance for groceries. She spent it very carefully, and usually had some money left over. She kept the extra cash in a box in a dresser drawer and used it for special things that she wanted, but didn't want to ask Mario to buy. If she needed to purchase something, he didn't refuse the request, but at times they disagreed on what was necessary for the children. Jane was determined that the children would have nice clothes, plenty of toys, and bikes to ride. Mario often questioned her purchases, but he usually relented. He mostly wanted assurance that Jane was spending his earnings wisely. In the 1960s, when the Maine department store downtown ball stores introduced credit cards, Jane experienced a new freedom. She didn't have to ask Mario up front for cash to buy clothes or makeup. She simply took out the little plastic card, and it was paid for. They developed a routine when returning home, with Mario asking, "Did you have a successful shopping trip?" Jane always answered, "Oh, yes, it was a lot of fun, and I got what I needed." She didn't see any reason to give details. He really didn't care about the dress that she'd bought. When the bill came due, Mario's secretary wrote the check. He didn't complain, so Jane assumed that she wasn't buying too much. She didn't like being dependent on him for all her money, but she had no choice. She was a housewife, and there was no way she could ever earn money on her own. The summer of 1953 was miserably hot, with no escape from the heat. An occasional light breeze blew through the open windows, but did little to cool the house. Jane was 8 months pregnant and exhausted. Worn down by the constant high temperatures and household chores, her belly made it difficult to do almost anything, and her hands and feet were swollen. After Rita was born, the doctor had insisted that she stay in the hospital for a week, not for any medical complications, but allowing her time to rest and recover. She didn't mind having her meals brought to her and sleeping as much as she needed. She hoped that her doctor would again order her to stay for a week after this pending birth. The only time she could relax was when 3-year-old Rita took a nap. Rita was an active child who required constant supervision more than any of the other two children. Anne kept an eye on her at all times, but Jane didn't want to burden her 10-year-old daughter. It wasn't her job to be a full-time babysitter, although it was helpful when she told her mother that Rita was getting into trouble. Yet, Rita's mischievous escapades often escaped detection. One of her favorite activities was to tie minuscule knots in the cords that pulled open the draperies. Jane discovered her handiwork when she tried to close the draperies in the evenings. The knots were almost impossible to get out. Jane hoped that her next baby would be less active. Part 2, Chapter 34, Abandon. I'm Mary, the youngest child of Mario and Jane. The previous chapters, written in third person, were based upon stories my parents told and were captured on both audio and videotapes. Transcriptions of those interviews and memories enabled me to quote them accurately, since I wasn't there during that time. I didn't arrive in the world until 1953, but the tapes, combined with the years of hearing their voices and extensive research, helped me to imagine their lives. Mom told me that she went into labor on the evening of August 12th. Dad took my siblings next door to our grandparents, and his Uncle Joe drove them to the hospital. Mom's labor was uneventful, and I, their fourth child, was born the next morning and named Mary Teresa. As anticipated, Mom's doctor insisted that she stay in the hospital for a week of rest. He knew that as soon as she was home, she'd be up and working. He wanted her to feel rested before allowing her to leave the hospital. And he was right. Mom was grateful that she had the extra rest, and there was little time to recover when she got home. My arrival necessitated some changes with the bedroom assignments. There were only 3 bedrooms upstairs. Rita and Nan shared a room, while John had his own. There wasn't enough space for me in the girls' room, and my parents didn't want to put a crib in John's room. A year before my birth, an addition had been built to the first floor, just off the dining room toward the back of the house. It was used as a den and an ironing room. Mom liked to iron there because she could keep the wooden ironing board set up. She always put away the iron, but felt that taking the heavy board down wasted her energy. It was quiet there, but still close to the living room where the children played. She could listen for any fighting or trouble and still get the ironing done. Mom and Dad decided to move John downstairs to the addition. They bought bunk beds, removed the ironing board, and made it into a cozy bedroom. John, who wasn't quite 7 years old, was upset by the move. He didn't like being so far away from the rest of the family. Mom didn't realize that he felt rejected or abandoned, until he complained as an adult, and while she wished that there had been another bedroom upstairs, then unfortunately they didn't have any better options. Although John felt isolated, his room wasn't far from the living room, where the new black-and-white television was installed in the corner by the fireplace. My siblings loved to watch television, especially Raymer of the Jungle and Howdy Doody. Rita, John, and Anne sat cross-legged on the floor, staring at the screen for as long as Mom would allow. Mom set up my playpen in the dining room and often put me there while she did chores, but I could see my siblings watching TV in the next room and wasn't happy about being stuck away from the action. My protesting cries made it impossible to hear the show, so Anne often rescued me, holding me in her lap. Of course, I stopped crying and happily watched the images flickering across the screen. One warm fall afternoon, when I was 3 months old, Mom put me down for a nap in my blue baby carriage. I was told that I fussed briefly, then slowly quieted. John, who was 6 and a half, peered into the carriage and smiled at me. He thought, maybe she'd like to go for a ride. That will help make her sleep. John heard Mom working in the kitchen and decided that he'd help her by taking me out for a walk. He managed to get the carriage out the front door and down the steps. John turned left and began pushing the carriage down the sidewalk along busy Jackson Street. By the time he got to the corner, John decided he was tired and laid down to rest on Mrs. Wellinger's front lawn. After a few minutes, John got up and skipped home, leaving me and the carriage behind. Soon after, the telephone rang in the front hall. "Mrs. Peroni? This is Mrs. Wellinger from down the street," said the neighbor urgently. "Yes, hello," Mom replied, wondering why she was calling her. "I just looked out my window and I saw Mary in her carriage out on my front sidewalk. She's by herself. I don't see anybody with her, and I don't know how in the world she got there." "What? I don't understand. She's taking a nap in her carriage. I just put her there a while ago. She can't be out on the sidewalk." Still trying to comprehend the situation, Mom paused, her heart pounding and panic building. "I'll tell you, she's there. Do you want me to bring her home?" "No, thank you. Anne and I will be right there." Mom hung up the phone. "Anne, come here. We need to get Mary. Did you take her for a walk?" "No, Mom. I've been playing with Rita. Where is Mary?" Mrs. Wellinger said that she is on the sidewalk in front of her house. "Hurry, let's go." Mom, who was not a runner, practically ran down the sidewalk while holding on to Anne's left elbow. "I see the carriage, Mom, and Mrs. Wellinger is there too," said Anne. Mom told me later that I was still asleep when they reached me, with Mom heaving a sigh of relief that I was safe. After exchanging greetings, Mom said to her neighbor, "I don't know how Mary got here. Anne and Rita were playing together. I can't imagine that John would take her by himself, but it must have been him," said Mom, still shocked that her baby had been abandoned along a busy street. "Thanks again, Mrs. Wellinger," said Mom, as they turned to push the carriage back home. She was mortified that she hadn't heard John take the carriage and prayed that nobody would call child welfare to say that she was an unfit mother. She worked hard every day to prove that her blindness didn't interfere with raising 4 children, but a 6-year-old leaving a baby alone on a sidewalk made her feel like an inadequate and neglectful mother. What if Mrs. Wellinger hadn't called her and instead called child welfare or the police? They could have accused her of child abandonment and taken her children away, her worst nightmare. Luckily, there was no investigation, but that was the end of John's unsupervised walks with me. Chapter 35, Mary's Story. I grew up in a loving household with parents who were patient and kind. Our family looked like other families who were at Sunday Mass or on television, my main frame of reference as a child, yet Mom and Dad's eyes didn't light up when they saw me or darken when I did something wrong. They had no idea what I looked like, but that didn't matter. They saw me by touching my hair, counting my toes, and giving me a bath. They heard my voice break with tears when I was upset and smiled when they heard laughter. There was never a defining moment when I realized that my parents were blind. An early clue for me was when, as a toddler, I looked up into their eyes and saw nothing. No emotion, except for the rare occasions when my father was angry. Then his big, scary eye got even bigger. His little eye, the one that had burst when he was four, was permanently closed. He couldn't open that eye. His eyes were frightening to me. My mother had artificial eyes. She could open them, but those glass orbs closed the door to her soul. Since I couldn't make eye contact with either of my parents, I learned to listen to their voice tones instead of looking at their faces. I didn't have to make eye contact to know that Mom was unhappy that I'd stolen a cookie before dinner. As an adult, I realized that I had a difficult time making eye contact with anyone and must remind myself to look at people in the eye. I'm more comfortable looking away while I listen to someone talk. It helps me to concentrate on what they are saying while I listen to their voice tone and hear the emotions underneath the words. I tend to get distracted if I try to watch a speaker's face. Visual cues are harder for me to read. When I try to gaze in someone's eyes, I have no idea what they're trying to tell me. I need auditory cues. The ubiquitous emojis on social media perplex me. I know the obvious smiley and unhappy faces, but I don't use the others because I'm not sure what they're trying to convey, and I'm afraid that I'll post something inappropriate. But I heard the sound of love from my parents' voices and their gentle touches. My mother had a very tender touch as she gently brushed my hair, bathed my small body, and changed my cloth diapers. I was about 5 years old when I started walking as a guide with them instead of holding my hand and watching for my safety. I still remember the feeling of their light grip on my elbow as we walked. If I wanted to show my mother something, perhaps my doll, instead of holding it up for her visual inspection or approval, she instructed me to put it in my hand and let me see it. She traced the outline of the doll's body with her fingers and felt the face, exclaiming what a pretty doll she was. I watched with great satisfaction as Mom examined my doll, then smiled as she handed it back, admonishing me to take good care of your dolly. In elementary school, my sister Rita and older sister Anne took the bus downtown to Van's Dance Studio every Saturday. Rita learned tap, ballet, and tumbling, while Anne concentrated on ballet. Ever the conscientious student, Rita often practiced her routines at home. As Mom forbade tap shoes on the tile kitchen floor, Rita solved that problem by climbing up on a wooden table along one wall of the basement. It was perfect for a stage, and Rita put on many shows, insisting that both parents come to watch her tap dance and sing. They dutifully clapped and cheered, providing her with the attention that she craved. Always practical, I didn't care about putting on a show, since they couldn't see me anyway. I had zero talent or interest in dancing. I much preferred riding my bicycle. It wasn't until my own daughter put on shows that I realized that I had never said, "Watch me, Mommy, look what I can do." Maybe I just didn't care to perform. I was a quiet child and preferred to stay in the background. But I never craved their attention, and even as a young child, I knew that since they couldn't see, their cheering felt empty. I took piano lessons from the second grade through middle school. I enjoyed the lessons, but like many children, I didn't practice enough. Playing for myself was fun, but I got too nervous while playing for others. I'd get distracted, lose focus, and make mistakes. I hated performing in the recitals. I still remember my sweaty hands on the piano keys. The Muncie newspapers used to publish accounts of my teacher, Mrs. Mayer's student recitals, naming every child and what they played. I found one article that read, "Mario Peroni will play a duet with his 9-year-old daughter, Mary." I have no memory of that recital, but now I wish that videos had been invented. I'd love to have seen that piece. I only remember at one time Dad played the piano at home. I was shocked at how good he was and asked why he didn't play more. He said, I can't play well enough to suit me. And he never played the piano again. Music filled the house. During the day, Mom listened to the local radio station. It played what's now called elevator music, mostly background music with lots of soaring strings. The living room had a stereo record player inside a stylish wood cabinet. My father had an eclectic collection of vinyl 33 RPM records, including classical music, musicals such as Oklahoma, and jazz albums. All were labeled in Braille. He often stacked four records on the spindle. The arm automatically dropped a new record when one side was finished, so he could sit comfortably in the overstuffed rocking chair, read his Braille magazine, and not have to get up when the record was over. Because they lived in a dark world, Mom and Dad were acutely aware of sound. They taught me to listen to the sound of a bird singing. Dad knew many birds by their song. I'm attuned to bird song as well. I stop and listen with delight to a bird's melody. Once a friend was chattering about nothing while I tried to listen to a cardinal. She was completely oblivious to the beautiful song. I impatiently hushed her so that I could listen. She looked at me with surprise, but at least stopped talking briefly. She was puzzled why a bird was more important than her, when she had important things to say. I apologized, but thought to myself that human talk isn't nearly as uplifting as the sound of a cardinal. The absence of sound when four of us were young usually meant that a child was doing something that they shouldn't be doing. When Mom realized we were too quiet, she'd come and check on us. Crayons were kept in a drawer and only brought out when she or Anne could supervise us. The scissors were hidden until we got old enough to be trusted not to cut our hair or injure ourselves. Mom did everything that she could do to ensure that we would be safe. When I was 8 years old, it was almost time for dinner, and I was starving. Mom was frying hamburgers on the electric skillet, which made enough noise that I thought she wouldn't hear me if I climbed up on the kitchen counter to reach the cookie cabinet. Stealthily, I swung my leg up onto the counter, then pulled myself up and opened the cabinet. Grabbing a Fig Newton, I quickly stuffed it into my mouth and tried to quietly lower myself down to the floor. "Mary, what are you doing? I hear you over there." "Nothing," I answered, while trying frantically to swallow the gooey cookie. "You have something in your mouth, don't you? Did you get a cookie?" "No, I don't," I protested weakly, knowing full well that I was busted. "You'll ruin your dinner. You know better than to eat a cookie before dinner. Shame on you. Now go set the table." It was very hard to misbehave around my parents. They heard everything. I wasn't a saint, but along with my Catholic upbringing, I developed a strong conscience and became a good girl. Besides, how could I dare disobey my blind mother and father? I don't remember what I did to provoke my mother when I was four, but I have a vivid memory of running around the dining room table, being chased by Mom, who was wielding the fly swatter. That was the usual discipline, to get tapped on the legs with a fly swatter. Suddenly, I felt terribly ashamed that I'd made my blind mother chase me and stopped running to await my punishment. I vowed not to ever make her chase me again. Besides teaching me to listen, Mom and Dad commented on the smells at home or while riding in the car. I can still hear Dad say, "My, that smells good," when he came into the kitchen. When we went for rides in the car after Anne turned 16, I loved going past the Colonial Bakery and the smell of Colonial bread baking. 60 years later, I can still remember that yeasty aroma. Our 1958 Chevy had no air conditioning, of course, so the windows were down during the summer. While my short hair blew wildly about, I heard Dad take a deep breath and say, "We must be passing a farm. I can smell earthy cow manure." It was especially pungent after a summer rain. I still appreciate the fresh Indiana country air when I return for visits. The sense of touch was especially important for Mom. She used her fingers not only to read Braille, but to wash dishes and clean surfaces. She felt every inch of a plate moving her fingers in search of a crumb or baked-on residue. Before we had a dishwasher, she did the dishes by hand. Each plate, piece of silverware, pot, and skillet was washed with a dishcloth, then thoroughly inspected by her sensitive fingers for anything left behind. "What's that?" she'd say to herself, picking out a particle stuck to a plate. "It feels sticky. Must be rice." Satisfied, she'd move the offending bit of rice. She dipped the plate back in the soapy water and scrubbed again. It was a long process, especially for an impatient child helping to dry dishes. When I complained about how long it took her, she responded, "How else can I know if it's clean?" Before the invention of permanent press in the mid-1960s, Mom sat on a stool behind the ironing board and ironed every wrinkled cotton shirt and handkerchief. The hot iron sizzled with steam as she moved it slowly and methodically across the fabric, feeling with her fingers for missed wrinkles. Sometimes her fingers got too close to the steam, and she jerked her hand back, softly murmuring, "Ouch!" But she didn't complain and went back to her task after cooling the finger quickly in her mouth. When I was 7, she'd asked if I'd like to learn how to iron handkerchiefs. She showed me how to sprinkle a little water on the fabric, then move the iron back and forth. I felt quite grown up that she trusted me with the dangerous hot iron. One day she left the room while I was finishing up the last of Dad's handkerchiefs. I got distracted by our cat and stopped moving the iron while I watched her play. Mom came hurriedly back saying, "What's that smell? Something's burning." Fortunately, it was only scorched and didn't catch fire, but I learned why you don't leave a hot iron on a spot for very long. Mom knew all our clothes by touch, remembering the color by the feel of the fabric and the shape of the piece. She knew that a smooth dress was buttons. On the front was my red dress. Her memory was as good as my dad's when it came to our clothes. She knew which blouse belonged to which sister and offered opinions on which top should go with a particular skirt. Mom did all the laundry, including hanging clothes back up in our closets. She never asked for help, although I'm sure that I put my own clothes back when I was older. I was in high school during the late 1960s, which was the height of the mini skirt fad. Of course, I wanted to wear what everyone else was wearing and bought skirts that came a few inches above the knee. Every morning before school, I had to submit to an inspection. Mom reached down and felt from my waist down to the bottom of the hem. "Mary, that's too short. I don't know who you can wear it that short, especially in winter." I wasn't about to admit the cold winter wind blew up my skirt and did chap my legs. I had to be fashionable. The temporary discomfort of walking to school in 20-degree temperatures was the price I was willing to pay. Mealtimes were special to my parents. Dinner was always served by 6 p.m., sometimes earlier if Dad had to attend an evening meeting. All 6 of us gathered nightly around the long, narrow table that barely fit in the breakfast room. Eating together gave us time to review our day. Dad often told funny stories about courthouse events and people. Politics were an important topic, although as a child, I asked to be excused because that was grown-up talk, and I'd long finished my meal. On weekends and holidays, when meals were more leisurely and relatives sometimes joined us in the dining room, Mom and Dad liked nothing better than to linger after a meal and talk. Dad enjoyed the intellectual discourse, and although Mom joined in, my guess is that she was happy to rest after working hard to prepare the meal. Relaxing over coffee helped to revive her prior to doing the dishes. It wasn't just talk that was important at meals. Enjoying each bite became a sensory experience. Since they had no visual cues, they never said, that looks good, but often commented on how something smelled or was particularly flavorful. They noted that the strawberries smelled fresh or if the bananas were overripe. Mom and Dad could easily tell by smell and touch. If how food looks is important in our expectations of how things will taste, then how the food smelled was the equivalent to Mom and Dad. And yes, they fed themselves and cut their own meat. Mom used her fork to feel around on her plate to look for food. Peas were hard to keep on a fork, but she often mixed them with applesauce, making them easier to scoop up. As an adult, when they came to my house for dinner, I'd use the clock analogy and tell them that the meat was at 12 o'clock, the potatoes at 3, and the broccoli at 9 o'clock. Knowing where everything was on the plate made it easier to decide where to begin eating. Besides never leaving toys on the floor, Mom's other major rule was no eating in the living room. We could eat only at the table, where spills could be easily wiped up and crumbs swept from the floor. Our black and white television was in the living room, and I have no memory of ever eating and watching TV. She was afraid that we'd make a mess in the living room and that someone would drop by and think that she was a poor housekeeper. She worried a lot about appearances. We rarely ate out when I was growing up. It was too expensive for a family of six. Eating out was reserved for very special occasions. Carry out was unusual in the 1950s and 60s, and that was something that those with cars enjoyed. Mom rarely got a break from cooking, but occasionally we'd eat lunch on a Sunday while shopping at the best department store in Muncie, Ball Stores. It had a cafeteria, and I read the menu and described the dishes to Mom. It was tricky to balance both of our trays while Mom held my elbow. If we were lucky, an employee would notice and carry her tray to our table. I liked cafeterias. Mom often asked, "What looks good today?" as we began our slow walk down the line. Of course, everything looked good, especially the cakes and pies, which were always displayed first. I tried to describe them as tantalizingly as possible, and often my ploy worked, as she suggested that we each get a piece. In restaurants, it irritated me when the waitress held out a menu for Mom. Couldn't she tell that Mom was blind? Apparently not. Some waitresses would silently stare at her face, not understanding why she wasn't reaching for the menu. I'd often have to rescue the woman by saying, "We just need one menu. Thanks." It didn't bother Mom that the waitress was standing there waiting for her to take the menu, but I was once again reminded that my mom was different, and being different in a way that was definitely not cool. If Mom or Dad knew what they wanted to order, it was easy. I only had to look for the desired items on the menu and read it to them to confirm their order. Other times, they'd ask me to read the whole menu, which as I grew older, I found embarrassing and time-consuming. It was embarrassing, because who else reads the menu out loud? And I was hungry, too. I didn't want to spend 10 minutes reading the menu. Sometimes I'd had to repeat the dishes' descriptions because they didn't remember it from the first reading. I learned which foods they didn't like, so I skipped over those items. Why read them something they won't order? Reading the menus aloud set us apart, but even worse was the typical waitress who couldn't make eye contact with Mom or Dad, so she'd look at me and say, "What does she want?" as if they were deaf or too stupid to speak for themselves. It was demeaning to them. I learned as a 6 or 7 year old to ignore the question and say, "Mom, what would you like?" When I was a teenager, I'd retort, "I don't know. Why don't you ask her?" I understand that many people don't know what to say to a blind person, but it's not hard. Just treat them like everyone else. Chapter 36. Freedom. When you were a child, did you ever close your eyes to see what it would be like to be blind? Perhaps you tried walking a few steps with your arms outstretched, hands waving as you tried to avoid walking into a wall. I couldn't keep my eyes closed for very long. It was too scary. I was greatly relieved when I opened my eyes and saw my familiar bedroom. I didn't want to be blind. That had to be the worst thing ever. But Mom and Dad didn't seem to be scared. They had already experienced the worst that could happen, losing their sight. Being blind was normal for them. I shuddered when I thought about losing my sight and prayed that it wouldn't happen to me. Dad often said that it's easier to lose your sight when you're young and don't know what you're missing. He expressed sympathy for those who had vision and lost it as an adult, saying it's much harder to adjust to a dark world after always being able to see. Children adapt very quickly and concentrate more on what they can do rather than what they can't. Both of my parents were very fortunate to have understanding siblings and nurturing parents, which undoubtedly allowed them to flourish. Neither of them felt sorry for themselves. They didn't waste time on self-pity. Both were practical-minded problem solvers who saw their blindness as an obstacle to overcome, not something to be preventing them from living. They weren't going to sit in a chair and be waited on. They wanted to live their lives independently and with dignity, making their own way in life. Yet their blindness caused much frustration because it prevented them from doing many things that sighted people take for granted. Mom couldn't tell if her lipstick was on straight, and Dad didn't know if he'd spilled a spot of soup on his tie. Mirrors were useless to them. We children became their mirrors when Mom asked if her dress was clean. I was glad that I could see and help them by reading the mail or the directions on a frozen pie. I didn't mind walking with Mom's hand on my elbow, guiding her safely down the sidewalk to the bus stop or church, at least not until I was an adolescent. Then I was embarrassed that people stared at us, and I felt constrained by her hand and having always to be on the alert for hazards. I am sure that my siblings felt the same way because we used to shake our heads and mouth, "It's your turn," while pointing at each other, waiting until one felt guilty enough to say verbally, "Mom, you want to walk with me?" We didn't want her to know that we were fighting over who had to walk with her, so the negotiations were all done silently. I was the youngest, so I rarely won. But it was a delicious feeling of freedom when Rita or John relented. I could skip or walk as fast as I wanted. As an adult, Anne told me how free she had felt when she went away to college. She didn't care about freedom in the sense that many teenagers use the term. They usually mean with no parents around, they can party all they want. Anne wasn't interested in partying. Her freedom was walking alone, without worrying about being responsible for a parent's safety. She was free to study and read all she wanted, no more monitoring her younger siblings. Anne became accountable only to herself. Having blind parents meant that we were dependent upon others or the local bus system for transportation, severely limiting our freedom to go where and when we wanted. Running errands required planning around bus schedules or waiting until someone could drive us. Anne was 16 when she got her driver's license, but she hated driving and only took us on short trips to visit Mom's sisters or Dad's brother, all of whom lived in Indiana. I envied my classmates who would return in September with stories about their vacation driving trips out west, how I longed to get out of Muncie and see the world. From elementary school age until I could drive, I enjoyed considerable freedom on my bike. My parents weren't concerned about me riding alone around our neighborhood or to my piano lessons. Muncie in the 1960s was safe, and I stayed off the busy streets. I often rode over to the field, a three-block square, empty lot near our house, and enjoyed riding on the path that cut through it diagonally. It was bumpy and a challenge to ride, which made it even more fun. While my bike was useful, I couldn't wait until my legs were long enough to carry the green tandem bicycle that had been parked in our garage since I was about 2 years old. Dad had wanted a way to enjoy an activity with my brother John. Dad felt bad that he couldn't do the things that other fathers did, such as playing ball, teaching John to hunt and fish, or taking him camping. I know that John often wished for a dad who could share activities like his friends' fathers. Dad wanted something that they could do together. He found the perfect solution in Indianapolis, a custom-made bicycle built for two. John could steer it in front, and Dad's powerful legs would provide the speed. They rode all over Muncie, with Dad teaching John the street names and basic traffic rules. Dad not only knew each street and which way it went, he knew the location of every stop sign and traffic light. He could even tell if John ran a stop sign. When my legs finally grew long enough, I took my turn in the front. Dad taught me the same things that he had told my siblings, but said that I was the one who was the speed demon. I loved going fast. It was such a feeling of power that I otherwise never got to experience. Dad didn't complain about having to pump harder. I think he loved the feeling of motion, too. I'm not sure what happened to that first bike. When I was about 10 years old, Dad bought a shiny new red Schwinn tandem with wire baskets and two side mirrors. It was great fun showing it off. Looking back, I'm amazed that he was so trusting of us kids. He couldn't see oncoming cars, though he heard them. But he didn't seem to worry about one of us steering into a pothole or being hit by a car. We never had an accident on the tandem, though I do remember many knee scrapes from falling off my own bike. Ever since I was 8 years old, I dreamed of getting my driver's license, that symbol of freedom. The years that I waited seemed endless. All my friends had parents who drove them places. If I wanted to go somewhere, I either walked, rode my bike, or took a bus. If my destination couldn't be reached by one of those modes of transportation, or if I couldn't find a ride, I stayed home. I spent a lot of lonely weekends wishing I could drive. Although Anne and John got their driver's license at age 16, they were only around for a couple of years and then left home for college. While I was glad to go for occasional rides with them, I yearned for my own independence. The years crawled by while I waited first for driver's ed, and then that glorious day when I got my license. Now I could drive the 7 blocks to school on rainy days, and even better, take my friends home. I could drive to my evening meetings for junior achievement and go to the library whenever I needed instead of shivering in the corner waiting for the bus. I took Mom to the store whenever she needed to buy groceries or even to doctor's appointments. She expressed many times to me how grateful she was that she could take a ride in a car again. She often had painful bladder infections, and I can't imagine how she managed to take the bus to the doctor when she was ill. Sometimes I drove Dad to evening visitations for deceased acquaintances at funeral homes. Dad knew a lot of people, and he often asked me to take him for a viewing to express his condolences. I walked with him around the crowded funeral home parlor, waiting patiently while he offered sympathy to the family and sneaking looks at the open coffin. In the fall of 1970, my senior year in high school, Dad ran for judge of the Superior Court. It was the first office that he'd campaigned for since I was born. I'm sure that the sting of losing the mayoral race in 1952, influenced him to leave politics. But as he got older and retirement became more likely, he decided that it would be good to have the steady income that being a judge would provide. He'd also be eligible for a pension, something that he wouldn't have had if he stayed with the law firm. Dad not only won the election, he was the top vote-getter. He was sworn in to the office of Judge of Superior Court on January 1, 1971. After the ceremony, I got to sit in his big leather chair behind the bench and bang the gavel loudly to bring the court to order. Instead of instant quiet and respect, I got scowls from Anne and Mom, which brought my legal career to a quick end. With almost 70,000 people, Muncie felt confining and boring to my 17-year-old self. I knew that there was a larger world to explore, and I was anxious to leave for college. I never considered going to Ball State University. It was nearly in my backyard, and I surely didn't want to spend 4 more years living at home. I decided that the University of Dayton was the right size, a city that wasn't too big and far enough away from Muncie that I felt independent, yet able to drive home in 90 minutes. I didn't think twice about leaving my parents alone. They were perfectly capable of living independently and never made me feel guilty about wanting to leave. Like Anne, I reveled in walking alone or with friends at college. I wasn't interested in drinking or partying either. My fear of failure prodded me to spend many hours studying and memorizing facts to regurgitate on exams. I worked very hard and earned a 3.9 GPA my first semester. I felt greatly relieved that I could handle my college classes, and although I was still terrified of failing, I knew that I would pass. While I was a sophomore at Dayton, my longtime high school sweetheart, Jeff Harper, asked me to marry him. He was a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and would be going on to graduate school the following summer. We married on June 23, 1973, and moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, where he earned his Ph.D. in pharmacology and I earned my B.S. in elementary education from the University of Virginia. 5 years later, we moved to a townhouse located near Chapel Hill, North Carolina, so Jeff could take a postdoctoral fellowship and conduct research at the University of North Carolina. We loved the ambience of the old college town. It was beautiful with lots of activities and events. I envisioned spending the rest of our lives there, figuring that surely Jeff could find a job at nearby Research Triangle Park, consortium of large science and technology companies. Meanwhile, my parents were living alone in our family house on West Jackson Street. My brother John, who had married and moved to Anderson, about 30 minutes away from Muncie, and divorced with two children, was working on her Ph.D. at Ball State, and Rita was married and living in Wisconsin. I was the farthest away, although we made trips back several times a year, and Mom and Dad visited us in Charlottesville. In 1978, Dad was approaching 65 and, having served two terms as county judge, decided it was time to retire. Mom was worried about having him underfoot all day, thinking he had few hobbies and would not have enough to do. The winters had become almost unbearable, and a recent blizzard frightened her when Dad had become temporarily lost in the snow. She described her fears in a call one day, and I suggested that perhaps they may want to consider moving to North Carolina. We had four seasons, but not as cold, and certainly not as much snow. I had just learned that I was pregnant with my first child. I was surprised when my proposal was met with enthusiasm. Could Mom and Dad leave Muncie after spending virtually all their lives there? Both were almost 65. Would it be too difficult to get used to a new home, learn a new community, and make new friends? Apparently not. They authorized me to find a realtor. Mom began the process of paring down a lifetime of accumulated possessions in preparation for their move. Dad announced that he would not seek re-election to a shocked community. Plans were made for them to leave Muncie at the end of December 1978, when Dad's term would expire. The first house that Jeff and I toured was perfect for them. It was one story with two bedrooms, two baths, and a large living room. Best of all was the screened-in porch located off the living room and master bedroom. They could sit out on the porch, feel the gentle breeze, and listen to the birds singing. The house was on a large wooded lot located on a quiet street across from a golf course. Even better, Dad could walk with Maddie, his seeing eye dog, to a neighborhood drugstore, a small grocery store, and bank. Mom and Dad wouldn't be totally relying on me to run errands for them. It took about 10 minutes for them to decide to make an offer on the house, literally buying it sight unseen. Mom and Dad always trusted me, whether with their lives when I was 16 and driving, or spending tens of thousands of their money on a house. Although I'd never given them a reason not to trust me, it still took a huge amount of courage to buy their first house since 1950 and move across the country where Jeff and I were the only people they knew. They arrived in Chapel Hill on January 2nd, 1979. Jeff and I, with a large pregnant belly, helped them unpack and familiarize them with the layout of the house. Our daughter was born about 3 weeks later, on the 19th, much to everyone's delight. Both of my parents loved Katie. They were thrilled to hold her, balancing her gently and making silly faces and noises. When Katie was about a month old, we didn't hesitate to have Mom and Dad babysit for us. It never occurred to me to worry about their ability to care for her. After all, they'd successfully raised four children. Life was good. My parents adjusted easily to their new home and began making friends at church and in the neighborhood. They took adult leisure classes and went to plays and concerts with friends. I'd go to their house and pay bills while they entertained Katie. other times I'd put Katie in her car seat and take Mom and Dad for rides or go on errands. I loved living in the small college town. It was especially nice to have my parents so close. It was a joy to watch them play with their granddaughter. Little did I know that our time together would be limited. Chapter 37, Big Changes. Late on a March afternoon, Jeff arrived home from the lab, took off his coat, and came into the kitchen where I was giving Katie her dinner. He kissed me hello, then smiled at his daughter and said, "Hi, Katie, what's for dinner?" "Cookie," she grinned up at her daddy. "You're not eating a cookie, that's a banana." Katie squished the piece of banana with her fingers and smiled, looking up for his reaction. "Oh, you're my silly one. Would you like some more milk?" While getting the milk carton from the refrigerator, Jeff casually turned to me and said, "Well, I have some news. Alton, his mentor and boss, has been offered a job in Houston. He'll be the department chair at the University of Texas Health Science Center." "Oh, that's interesting," I said. "And he wants me to come with him. I would be an assistant professor of internal medicine and pharmacology. It would mean a good salary and my own lab. I get to teach pharmacology to med students, too." Stunned by the news, I was less enthusiastic. "What? You mean leave Chapel Hill? We just moved into this house 9 months ago. What about my parents? How could I leave them and take their beloved grandchild?" I tried not to sound upset. I didn't want Katie to catch my fear and disappointment. "Can't you get a job here in the Research Triangle? There's lots of technical jobs there, and we wouldn't have to move." "I don't want to work in industry. I want to be in a university or medical school where I can do my own research. Alton is going to Houston in a couple of weeks. He wants me to come with him. I have some interviews, and you can look at houses." I was devastated. Worst of all, it appeared that I had no choice in the matter. I would follow my husband to a sprawling city where I knew no one and would have no support raising our daughter. I'd never lived in a big city and had no idea what to expect. All I knew about Houston was that it was full of violent crime, unbearably hot and humid, and had monstrous traffic-clogged freeways. Moving to the big city from the idyllic Chapel Hill terrified me. Mom and Dad took the news better than I expected. They offered to babysit Katie for the weekend, and I didn't think twice about leaving my 17-month-old child with Mom or Dad for the spring weekend when we flew to Houston to find a house. After all, they'd raised 4 children and were thrilled to have their granddaughter stay with them. Upon our return, Katie ran to greet us with a big smile and twinkling eyes, with Mom following close behind. While hugging Katie, I asked Mom how things had gone. "Oh, she was just perfect. We had so much fun with her. We played and she took naps and we had a fine time." Dad came into the room and added, "Oh, yes, Katie was such a good girl. You know she loves my dog, Matty." We'd put her in the high chair and give her some Cheerios. Pretty soon, I heard Matty go over to the high chair. I wonder what she was doing when I heard, "Uh-oh," and some crunching. I realized that Katie was dropping Cheerios down for the dog. She thought it was so funny to watch the dog eat those Cheerios. She'd laugh and laugh. "Well, Dad, you wouldn't let us ever feed the dog from the table." "I know, but she's such a cute little thing, and it didn't really hurt anything." Dad's response surprised me, since Dad has always enforced the strict rule about his dogs. Although my daughter's dropping Cheerios from her high chair was similar behavior to my brother's when he was that age, Dad didn't seem worried that Maddie would become too attached to Katie, as Baron had to my brother. I noticed that as Dad got older, he relaxed more around the dogs, although they were never allowed on the furniture. His last two dogs, Job, a golden retriever, and Admiral, a yellow Labrador, were much loved and almost became pets. Mom took an interest in both dogs and developed a daily routine. Admiral reminded her every morning at 11 that it was time for his milk bone treat and circled her, excitedly wagging his tail as Mom made her way to the kitchen. Mom and Dad talked for days of how much they enjoyed having Katie at their house, describing in detail what they had done together. Although I was delighted that her visit had worked out so well, it only made me sadder, realizing that I'd be taking Katie away in only a few weeks. Although Mom and Dad reassured me several times that they had lived on their own for many years before I was born and would manage okay without me, I still felt terribly guilty for leaving them only a year after their move to North Carolina. I'd missed seeing them and wondered who would take them to doctor's appointments or the store or pay their bills. I was saddened that Katie would not grow up with her grandparents nearby. Their friends and neighbors took up the slack, offering rides to appointments, church, and the grocery store. One person put a help wanted notice up on a bulletin board at the university, advertising for someone to read mail and pay bills once a week. The young sorority girl who answered the ad turned out to be a trusted friend who, when she graduated, found another girl from her sorority who would take her place. My parents kept in contact with all their girls for years afterwards, delighting in their Christmas cards. To help relieve my guilt about leaving my parents behind in Chapel Hill, Katie and I flew back to visit them several times during that first year. Jeff was working and couldn't go with us. I have no idea how I managed a squirmy toddler, stroller, luggage, and car seat by myself. Mom and Dad were always happy to see us and excited to play with their granddaughter. I was glad to help out with the errands and things around the house. When my second child, Andrew, was born in October 1981, Mom and Dad flew to Houston and helped me care for both children. Mom especially loved babies and enjoyed holding Andrew and making funny faces to entertain him. As Katie and Andrew grew, my parents taught them how to interact with them. If Katie held up a doll for her grandmother to admire, she had instructed Katie to put the doll in her hand so she could feel the doll's face and clothes. "Oh, she has on such a pretty dress. What color is it, Katie?" Both grandchildren quickly learned the rule that I'd grown up with: never leave your toys on the floor where Grandma or Grandpa could step on them. I always felt a little sad that it was harder for my children to enjoy my parents. Mom couldn't drive my children to the park or take them for ice cream or play Candyland. In contrast, Jeff's parents lived in Maine and Florida with swimming pools on the beach to entertain them. Jeff's mother took the kids to museums and enjoyed taking Katie shopping. Every night that we visited, she'd read a book to Katie and Andrew before bedtime. My parents could do none of those things, but they were good listeners and always showed an interest in their grandchildren's activities, whether it be admiring preschool artwork, "What colors did you use, Katie?" or listening to Andrew play the guitar as a teenager. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.